Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. The scholar Louis Dupree has called Afghanistan a nation of poets. The country has a long literary history at the heart of Central Asian culture, producing poets and writers from Rudaki to Rumi. It's a land where the ancient art of storytelling is still held in high esteem. It's also been the setting of great Western literary works from authors like Rudyard Kipling and George MacDonald Fraser. But in years of the Taliban, warlords, and Soviet invasion, the written word has suffered. Tonight, we rebroadcast our October series on Afghan literature to take a different look at Afghanistan, not through newspapers or TV analysis, but from those who have captured the country and culture on a literary level. We begin by looking back to the classical literature of Afghanistan.
The Juyi Mulyan we call to mind. We long for those dear friends long left behind. The sand of Uxus, toilsome though they be, beneath my feet were soft as silk to me. Glad at the friends return the Uxus deep, up to our girth and laughing wave shall leap. Long live Bukhara, be thou of good cheer, joyous towards thee hasteth our Amir. The moon's the prince, Bukhara is the sky, O sky, the moon shall light thee by and by. Bukhara is the mead, the sire is he, receive at last, O mead, thy cypress tree.
The ancient region of Khorasan, which encompassed modern-day Afghanistan, Iran, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan, was the home of Central Asian culture during its classical period, between the 10th and 13th centuries. And Abu Abdullah Rudaki was known as first poet of the Dari language. From Rudaki came the writers Ferdowsi, Avicenna, and Jalaluddin Rumi, who are still read and recited today. We talked about a few of these great classical writers with William Beeman, a professor of anthropology and Middle East studies at Brown University. So we just heard a bit of Rudaki. Tell us what to make of that and give us some interpretation.
Rudaki was almost the very first poet to write in modern Persian. And it's important to note that he lived in the 10th century. He died in 940 AD. And his poetry is completely understandable by people who speak modern Persian. And this poem, in legend, was supposedly recited to the then king that he served under, who was living in the city of Herat in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. The seat of government was Bukhara, and the king had abandoned Bukhara for the pleasures of Herat. And the people of Bukhara were getting a little upset because there were potholes in the streets and the so they hired Rudaki to go to the emir and to persuade him to come back. And he recited this poem in which there are all these images about the emir being the moon and Bukhara being the sky. And supposedly he was so completely taken with this imagery that he jumped onto his horse without even putting on his boots and rode straight back to Bukhara.
So this speaks perhaps to the perceived power of art in Afghan cultural history.
No question that poetry has been revered in Afghanistan and in the surrounding areas for more than 1,000 years. And the fact that the language has been so conservative that people today can read it with great pleasure and, in fact, memorize these verses. The verse that you heard from Rudaki is something that, honestly, every school child knows.
Today, we think, rightly or wrongly, of Afghanistan as a rough, rugged outback, but I hear you describing it as a kind of cultural center. Who were the big pillars there?
Well, you have to understand that from the 9th century to the 14th century, this area of Afghanistan was probably the cultural center for all of the Middle East. The great scientists and poets were there, and some of the greatest were Rudaki, who we've mentioned, and coming on later, Ferdowsi, who wrote the great epic poem, the Shahnameh, the Book of Kings, mm-hmm. in the beginning of the 11th century. And finally, Jalaluddin Rumi, known as Rumi here in the United States, who lived a little bit later in the 13th century.
When you look at Rudaki, Ferdowsi, and Rumi, are there Western literary figures that they might be comparable to in their standing there?
Well, I think of the great epic poets like Homer or Dante or Milton. Certainly their stature in the Middle East is as great as these poets are in the West. And to be honest with you, their stature is well deserved.
So can you distill some of the primary cultural values that are embedded in these works for us as we look at Afghan society today? What comes down through the ages through this literature?
One of the things about Ferdowsi in particular is that it is both a heroic and a romantic tradition. So that we have great poetry that deals with battle and heroism in battle and nobility. But at the same time, they're great love stories.
So the passion is there. What other great cultural tradition or values do we see reflected?
Well, if we move to some of the other poets, particularly Rumi, we see that these poets embody also a mystical Islamic tradition, a Sufi tradition. There is no question that Rumi's poetry tries to explore the inner life and the search for the absolute, the search for God. And he uses tremendously powerful metaphors. One of the more hackneyed metaphor is the metaphor of the moth and the flame. And we think of the moth and the flame as a metaphor that has to do with maybe some kind of tawdry romantic attachment. But for Rumi, the secular love, that is the love of another person in a romantic sense, was a metaphor for a love of God. And the moth, as the moth approaches the flame, it's the same as the human being who desires a union with God approaching that which is ineffable and all-powerful.
If you sit back and look at the terrain of classical Western literature and then shift and look at this classical Persian or literature, I guess, are there marked differences that come to mind in looking at this cultural bedrock?
I think that in the West, we have tended to develop poetry as an aesthetic exercise completely abstracted from the rest of society. Mm-hmm. In the Middle East, in these poetic traditions, they almost always have a larger purpose. They either are designed, as in the epic tradition of Ferdowsi, to stir feelings of patriotism, nationalism, some of the higher emotions, I guess one would say, or they are, in the Sufi tradition, designed to instruct.
I was swept away by the passion and mysticism of Rumi's poetry, but he can also be very practical sometimes. I saw a few verses. He said, "Whoever acts with respect will get respect. Whoever brings sweetness will be served almond cake."
That's true. In fact, there's quite a lot of humor in Rumi as well. Many, many jokes, some of which have a mystical meaning. For instance, the story that some of your listeners may know from another source, where Juha, the wise fool, is looking for something, and his friend comes up and says, "What are you looking for?" And he says, "I dropped a coin," and his friend helps him look for a while. And he says, "Well, but I can't find it. Where did you drop it?" And Juha says, "Well, in the house." And his friend says, "Why are you looking for it here?" And Juha says, "Ah, the light is better here." And what Rumi means, of course, is that the light of enlightenment, or the light of God, is where you need to look for truth.
William Beeman is a professor of anthropology and Middle East studies at Brown University. From classical literature, we move to those Western writers who have written about Afghanistan.
"Kabul town is sand and dust. Blow the bugle, draw the sword. I'd have sooner drowned fast instead of him beside the ford. Ford, 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 a Kabul river. Ford, a Kabul river in the dark. You can hear the horses thrashing. You can hear the men a-splashing. Cross the ford, a Kabul river in the dark."
The English writer Rudyard Kipling, more than any other writer, has formed the West's image of Afghanistan. His journalistic pieces, poems, and books like Kim and The Man Who Would Be King portray Afghanistan as a rugged land with even more rugged people. How close was Kipling's Afghanistan to the Afghan reality, and how much has Kipling shaped the Western perspective of that land? For answers, we talked with Michael Smith, Vice President of the Kipling Society. You've spent a career looking at the work of Rudyard Kipling. He's probably the Westerner who's had the most to do with creating the Western images and ideas of South Asia, Central Asia, and Afghanistan.
That's perfectly true, although in fact he only spent just over 12 years of his lifetime in the Indian subcontinent, five as a small boy and then seven as a working journalist, in which he made a tremendous reputation.
What's so astonishing today is how Kipling's work of decades and decades ago now still seems to frame this region. It lives in the minds of so many people. I know my own father always quoted Kipling. There's a grave by the Pangbang River, a grave that the Burmans shun. I remember hearing that as a child, and there's a magic about it. It worked. Personally, I was off to India before I was 19 years old. Right. What is it that makes it so compelling? And I guess more importantly, is it an accurate and useful reflection of this region today?
Oh, I'm sure it is, although he was concentrating, when he was talking about Afghanistan, on the Afghan war that had been fought just before he came out. It was seared into his consciousness, and he wrote some of the stories about some of the activities that our troops had gone through and some of the terrible disasters which had befallen them when they were in Afghanistan. And as a reporter, he covered the rival through the Khyber Pass of the Emir of Afghanistan, who the new viceroy, Lord Dufferin, was going to welcome in Peshawar, because we wanted to produce a buffer state between the Raj and the likely invasion coming from Russia.
Michael Smith, as we opened this segment, we heard a passage from Ford or Kabul River, where Kipling writes about British soldiers in the dark, in battle, in danger, in Kabul. Can you give us a sense of that and what was going on there? And how well did Kipling portray the Afghanistan of his time?
Well, he certainly portrayed them very well, although he realized that they were incredibly good fighters and they fought a totally different kind of war to that which the British Army was used to fighting. And we have, I think, learned from that, and we tend now to fight more of a guerrilla war than we would have done in the past. But the Ford of Kabul River was the fact that two squadrons, one of the 10th Hussars and one of the 11th Bengal Lancers, were ordered to ford the River Kabul and get behind some enemy tribesmen. And in doing so, the lancers crossed, but the last two of their donkeys were washed away. And by that time, the speed of the river and the encumbrances of their uniforms and of the packs they were carrying meant that the horses that they were riding slipped away off the ford into the water. And so 47 English soldiers were actually died as a result of that disaster.
So could you share with us a bit of how he described the Afghan? Do you have anything you could read that might give us a flavor for the character of the Afghan?
Yes, there's a lovely piece on the dispatches that he sent back from Jamrud, the foot of the Khyber Pass. And one goes like this. These are two of the chieftains of the Emir of Afghanistan arriving in the camp to discuss the arrangements for the reception of their master. Two of his sirdars arrived in camp this morning and are at present enjoying their midday meal. Neither Qazi Qutbuddin nor Aga Haider Shah were pleasant to look on as they squatted on their charpoys and asked all manner of questions regarding the arrangements of the camp. The Aga was clad in a camel's hair garment adorned with gold stripes, and his lower limbs were encased in what looked remarkably like European trousers. He was a short, thick-set, and of florid countenance, laughing and talking a good deal. The Qazi, who lounged about picturesquely in a corduroy waistcoat with brass buttons and a pair of snowy white pyjamas, was meagre, red-haired, and much lined and seamed with exposure. Well, they would have been dressed rather differently to the normal Afghan, whose, I think, dress hasn't changed very much in the last 100 years.
But then look at it right there. He begins by saying neither was pleasant to look on. Isn't that the voice of the imperialist British observer looking down his nose at the local people?
No, I think it meant that they were simply extremely unshaven. They had a growth of beard and they hadn't washed naturally for quite a long time, although probably they wouldn't have done so if they'd had the chance. I don't think he's sneering at it. It's a very good dispatch, I think.
You know, I'm being hard on Rudyard Kipling, but I have to admit I'm not the least bit immune to the magic of what he writes. But I do notice that again and again, Kipling comes back to writing about some kind of imbalance where the Westerner is there with a lot of money spent on educating that man and transporting him to South or Central Asia and arming him and equipping him, and then he's brought low by a stone.
Yes, this appears in a poem called Arithmetic on the Frontier. A scrimmage in a border station, a canter down some dark defile, 2,000 pounds of education drops to a 10-rupee desile. Well, of course, those troops were there really to try to keep peace between rival Pathan factions. And, of course, the Afghans are a Pathan people, and they were constantly warring between each other. And it was the extraordinary fact that an ordinary desile, a very cheap rifle, made locally up in the northwest frontier with a very long barrel, which usually had to be held up by a notched stick, was able to kill somebody who had had so much training and education.
2,000 pounds. In other words, expensive education killed by one shot from a cheap rifle in the mountains of Afghanistan.
That's right. Now, of course, it would probably be a Stinger missile and a multi-barreled mortar that would be fired at our troops.
We'll have more on the poetry and literature of Afghanistan after a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the poetry and literature of Afghanistan to take a different look at the land and its people. We continue our conversation with Michael Smith, Vice President of the Kipling Society, about the influence of Rudyard Kipling on the Western perception of Afghanistan. Did Kipling draw a distinction between Afghanistan and the rest of the subcontinent in terms of the character of the people there?
Yes, he did, because, of course, the Afghans were a Pathan people who were Muslims, and he lived in Muslim India for the first 5 years of his work on the Civil and Military Gazette, and he had a very great affection for the Musliman. I mean, he described his own form and compositor, Mian Rukhandin, in these terms: "A Mohammedan gentleman of a kind heart and infinite patience, who I never saw unequal to a situation and was my loyal friend throughout." Well, you can't claim that that had been written by anybody who was a racist.
When you look at the explosion of coverage of this region in just the last month and a half, Michael Smith, do you see Kipling's fingerprints on the way we look at Afghanistan and the region today and the way we write and speak about it?
I'm not sure that that is the case, because, of course, Kipling is a specialist interest and not very many English people know a great deal about him. Although his writing about the area was superb, describing the craggy, rocky terrain, the drought, the dust, the extreme hardship of conditions. And so I don't think his descriptions, except for the very well-educated, would count for very much.
Have you seen him quoted in headlines or magazine articles?
I have indeed, yes. There's some superb ones recently. For example, on September the 12th, the Daily Telegraph leader was banner-headed by a sentence, "The Tempest Long Foretold," which was the words that he used in a 1932 poem called "The Storm Cone," warning of the rise of the Nazi Empire. And there's one other, of course, which you're familiar with in the United States, "Take Up the White Man's Burden." He was exhorting the United States to rise to the challenge of colonialism in that poem, and he said very presciently in it, "The white man's burden would draw the blame of those ye better, the hate of those ye guard." Well, that is true today.
We've spent decades disparaging this notion of picking up the white man's burden. If Kipling looked out on what's going on in the world and in Central Asia today, what do you think he would observe in those terms?
Well, I think he would think of it in terms that he was used to, and that is the fact that the then British Army, now the American Army and Navy and the Air Force and the British Army and Navy and Air Force, would be doing a policing role, trying to make the world a better place. And I'm sure he would actually approve of it.
In his Barrack Room Ballads, Kipling described the Afghan fighter in a ballad called "The Young British Soldier." It might be the most widely known Western passage about Afghanistan. I'd love for you to read about it.
Yes, it's been used for a number of cartoons at various times, and less horrible than the circumstances we're in now. "When you're wounded and left on Afghanistan's plains, and the women come out to cut up what remains, just roll to your rifle and blow out your brains and go to your gourd like a soldier." I mean, it's an incredibly horrible factor, but that did happen, because we lost an awful lot of soldiers in at Maiwand, in the Afghan wars, and in other combats that we had in that country.
And Michael Smith, any other passage less gory that we might go out on?
There's a rather nice one about on fort duty, because our soldiers were up in the very remote, isolated forts in this very dangerous region. "There's a tumult in the Khyber. There's a feud at Ali Kyle. For the Maliks of the Khyber are at it tooth and nail with a stolen British carbine and the long Kohat Jizail." Well, this, of course, is an amazing poem, because they used to make their own rifles. I've actually visited factories where they made exact copies of any weapon that you like to name.
Michael Smith is vice president of the Kipling Society. And now, women in Afghanistan's literary life.
Where is the ear to hear my cries? Where is the eye to see my tears? I am the ashes of a hopeless fire. Where is the wind to refresh my flames? I am a silent dervish sitting in the cell of my grief. Where is the flute to sing my sorrows?
Under the Taliban's strict rules, probably the most silenced voice in poetry and literature was that of women. Although contemporary writers are now being read in exile, the voice is still strongly male. Fawzia Barlas is an Afghan poet and writer. Her latest book of poetry is called The Heavens Are My Father. Fawzia Barlas has also served as an educator, advisor, and encourager of Afghan women writers. We talked with her before the Taliban's defeat about the women's voice in Afghan literature. How active are Afghan women in writing? Is there anything going on inside Afghanistan? And if not, is there a center?
Well, inside Afghanistan, there's nothing. No voice, no writing at all. But I think that women outside of Afghanistan, they're the sort of active, but still the number of women who are involved in writing are very, very limited. And especially in respect to poetry and short story writings, we don't have, because we don't have that many publications outside the country to raise their voice and to invite their participation in these things.
So women writing today are, first of all, writing in exile, and secondly, is it a revolutionary act to write as an Afghan woman?
Yes. As much as I understand, it looks to be, because inside Afghanistan, they're totally silenced. But outside, when they look around, they learn from the society they live, especially in West. And so they try to join and they try to share the agony of women who live inside Afghanistan. And they find the encouragement to express themselves and to be something.
As we opened our conversation, you read a lovely poem with the image of a woman turning like a silent dervish.
That's right.
What are you suggesting there, Fawzia?
I wrote this poem when I heard the massacre of an entire village in the north of Afghanistan, that the people who simply couldn't speak Pashto.
Mm-hmm.
And then I said, is there anybody to really listen to these people? And I just wanted to be their voice, and I just wanted to be the voice of those women who had nothing to do. And I wrote that poem maybe after I heard that news and I watched on TV. Mm-hmm. I tried to express that, okay, who am I? I have everything, but nobody listens to me. So I look at myself like a dervish who just has a world inside.
And for those of us who don't know Afghan culture as well, a dervish is a mystic in the Afghan culture.
Definitely, and it's a very, very strong image in our culture. And dervish is also the symbol of purification, the symbol of love and peace and the purity of spirit and soul. So when I use the word of dervish, I mean everything, that, okay, I am clean, I am fresh, I have so many things to offer, and I am love, and I am peace. But okay, if nobody listens to me, if nobody sees my tears, then I need really a flute to express myself. And this flute maybe can be my poetry, can be my writing. Not only me, actually. I'm talking about women, yeah.
When you write about love, Fawzia Raghazar Barlas, how do the current circumstances of Afghanistan affect that line of writing?
Well, this is a nice question. I mean, that when sexuality and stuff is involved, I try to avoid it. But still, I have the voice to say, okay, my body can be tortured. I will suffer there, but my spirit is so free. That's why in one of my poems, when I say, I am in love, I am in love, I am in love, you, the parched pieces of my body, you, the unfelt freedom of my senses, grow hot, boiling, steaming, for I am the fire, I am the fire, I am the fire. This is only a piece of my long poetry when I describe that as a woman, I am the air, I am the fire, I am the flower and everything. And then, of course, I express my own desires for a man or for love or whatever.
The writer always carries some responsibility to speak for their culture, but you must feel it especially heavily in your case when Afghans and especially women have no voice.
Oh, definitely, yes. This is the part that when I think about the history of Afghanistan, at least the recent history that I witnessed, I cannot blame only men. I'm not talking about Taliban, of course. I'm mm-hmm. talking about the history. Mm-hmm. And then I see that women in Afghanistan never fought in their rights. There has never been any kind of organized movement for women issues. Mm-hmm. And so they must be also blamed for that silence. I read so many books to find if there has been any kind of movements for women freedom and stuff. There were very local, very weak, very disorganized, just limited to a certain group of people. That was it.
Do you see signs in the writing of Afghan women today that that might change?
Well, I think so. I received some magazines from Canada and from Pakistan, where so many women are living there. And I feel that, yes, now they seem very precise and they want to raise their voices. But the very huge problem that I believe at the moment I witness is the kind of language barrier. They cannot introduce themselves in the languages of the countries that they live. And so they can express themselves only in Persian. And Persian, how many publications do we have in Persian?
Not too many.
We have a poet. Her name is Leila Sarahat. And she is the poet of pain and agony because she has suffered a lot herself. Her father was executed. Her sister was died for some reason. And this lady is one of the best contemporary poets in Afghanistan. And also we have another lady. Her name is Bahar. She just expresses her female feelings about love and sexuality and making love. And she's outspoken, too. And Farooq is her name, and she lives in Pakistan. She's one of the best as well.
We think of the suffering that's gone on in Afghanistan, but you write of Kabul, the capital, as the sweet city of my sweet memories. How long has it been since you lived there, and what's the image that you're referring to?
Yes, I raised in a very wealthy and highly educated family, and I'm from Mazar-i-Sharif, from north of Afghanistan. Mm. And I had a dream childhood. And so it is 27 years that I left Afghanistan, and I was only a teenage. But, of course, at that time, the war was not still there. But when I remember my own childhood, and then I remember the very painful moments of today's children in Afghanistan, it makes me the kind of sad. I mean, I can never compare the Afghanistan that I saw, the Afghanistan that I enjoyed, and the kind of liberal Islam that my family were experiencing around me, and the men and their respect and love, even from my grandmother that I remember.
Do you see room for hope?
Oh, definitely. I can say that very bravely, that when I heard America is sending troops, I said, oh, America, I love you. I know that you will take freedom there. And I will see that women will walk again in the street and children will go back to school. I'm very optimistic and very hopeful.
You've written a short story called Princess of Waltzes. It's based on the true story of a war victim that you met in Vienna in 1995. I'd like to ask you to read just the conclusion of that story. This is where the woman in exile is 3 months out of Kabul. She's now in Vienna. Could you read that for us?
Okay. She looked at herself carefully. Purple halo circled her hazel eyes. Her long and maroon hair in two bridles was hanging from both sides of her pale cheeks. The dark color of her dress made her look even paler. And then I continued to describe her, and then I say that, okay, she came closer to the mirror, removed the dust from the surface with her elegant hands, and at the very depth of her silent and gloomy eyes, she saw a fantastic dream. A pretty princess was laughing heavenly in the secured arms of her father. Waltzes were flying beyond the ancient walls of Vienna towards the boundless blue skies. And there, in that white and peaceful top of the sky, nobody was in captivity of the walls of the sanitarium. A litter, not at all.
Fawzia Barlas is an Afghan poet and writer. Her latest book of poetry is called The Heavens Are My Father. Now, the ancient art of storytelling.
A grammarian once embarked in a boat. Turning to the boatman with a self-satisfied air, he asked, "Have you ever studied grammar?" "No," replied the boatman. "Then half your life has gone to waste," the grammarian said. The boatman thereupon felt very depressed, but he answered him nothing for the moment. Presently, the wind tossed the boat into a whirlpool. The boatman shouted to the grammarian, "Do you know how to swim?" No, the grammarian replied, my well-spoken, handsome fellow. In that case, grammarian, the boatman remarked, the whole of your life has gone to waste, for the boat is sinking in these whirlpools. You may be the greatest scholar in the world in your time, but consider, my friend, how the world passes away and time.
With a 75% illiteracy rate in Afghanistan, the literary tradition of the oral narrative entertains, cautions, and educates. These anecdotes and stories, both musical and spoken, are handed down through families and adopted to address current needs. We talked with Margaret Mills, the chair of the Near East Studies Department at Ohio State University and author of Rhetoric and Politics in Afghan Traditional Storytelling, about this great tradition. We just heard one quick story there. It's from the oral tradition. Tell us about the importance of the oral tradition of storytelling in Afghan culture.
Well, actually, to back up a little bit, that story certainly is readily available in oral tradition in a lot of places, but it is probably one of the more famous stories from the Masnavi Manavi, the spiritual quatrains of Jalaluddin Rumi. In fact, that work is a cornucopia of stories that are also known in oral tradition. When you think about Afghanistan, it's well to remind ourselves that at maximum, there might be something like 25 or 30% functional literacy, which means people can write their name and maybe decipher a line of the Quran, the minimal literacy. And then, of course, there are people who are highly literate and have a great deal of education. But by far, something on the order of 70% of the population has no reading and writing skills at all.
So is there a tradition alive right now of people sitting around and sharing stories passed down over centuries?
Yes, certainly, and I think that it comes to play, as does narrative in our culture to some extent, when people really need to make sense out of chaotic situations. They look for scenarios and causal themes that they know about, so they reach for narrative and they reach for traditional narratives to make sense out of life. And this has been true, you know, over centuries, and certainly richly true for Afghans, that often if you want to make a moral point to someone, what you do is tell a story, and if they get the connection, then they get it. And if they don't get it, there's a famous proverb in Persian that the answer to a fool is silence. If you didn't get it, you didn't get it.
The story we heard just a minute ago seems to suggest a kind of deep pragmatism.
Yes.
No matter how fancy the grammarian's view of the world, the boatman knows you have to be able to swim.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that this story is quite likely to ring very true for Afghans who see us going in with highly sophisticated, highly technological approaches to life, and what they don't really know is where the whirlpool is and how to swim when you don't have your equipment.
Are there other stories that are popular on the oral tradition circuit in Afghanistan in recent years?
Well, yeah, there's stuff that is also very literary that I think can be brought to bear, and there's other things that are what we would consider to be jokes. Maybe a quick one-liner is in order. This was told about the time that the Soviets were leaving after 10 years. It was a question and answer, and the first question was, why did the Soviets come to Afghanistan? And the answer is they were invited.
Mm-hmm.
And then, well, why did they stay so long? Oh, they were looking for the guy who invited them. That was an Afghan joke, and I wouldn't be all surprised that that's being recycled or will be soon. Another that is, again, one of these oral literary things is a story about the bear's friend,
mm-hmm.
which turns up in another mystical poet, Jami, who's a poet of Herat. And the story goes that a man had befriended a bear cub and raised him up, and they were good friends, and the bear was inseparable with his buddy. And one day he was sitting with his human friend while the human friend was taking a nap, and a fly kept landing on the man's forehead, and the bear kept trying to brush it away, and the fly would come back, and finally the bear got really mad, and he got a big rock, and he coshed the fly on his friend's forehead with the rock, and of course he killed his friend. So the point is, you really need to choose friends who are wise, and that's probably something that Afghans are thinking about pretty intensely right now.
Presumably, many Afghans are right now thinking about how to look at the United States anew and whether or not we're a dangerous bear or a valuable friend.
Right, I think so. I would.
We'll have more Afghan storytelling, poetry, and literature after a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the poetry and literature of Afghanistan, looking from a different angle at the land and its people. We continue our conversation on the ancient art of storytelling in Afghanistan with Margaret Mills, chair of the Near East Studies Department at Ohio State University and author of Rhetoric and Politics in Afghan Traditional Storytelling. What do you think is most important for Americans to take away from the Afghan oral tradition in terms of understanding aspects of that culture that we may need to understand in the months and years ahead?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One is how very much of kind of moral commentary is mediated indirectly. Like, you won't necessarily get people saying, here's what you need to know and here's what you need to think. But you get indirect statements that need to be read as reflections on actual events. But besides that, also, as in a lot of oral traditions, there's an enormous thematic emphasis in Afghan oral literature on justice and on underdogs who somehow manage to secure justice against all odds. And I don't think it's hard to see the country, its general population, as being pretty obvious underdogs at this point. This is to say, you know, to hold apart the issues of the Taliban and Osama and their role in geopolitics at this point. Most of the population there has virtually nothing, and they're going to have less. And so the ability to secure justice from a position of weakness, which is really, really widespread in Afghan oral tradition, is going to be a theme that will be on people's minds.
Are Afghan children still learning these stories today, even in the disruption that currently afflicts the country?
I wonder. I think probably, but I also know that because of the interruptions of widespread refugeedom in the 80s, people who were major carriers of oral tradition lost the opportunity to share that tradition. And when I went back to Herat briefly in the 90s, I found a generation my own age, you know, 40, 50, 60-year-olds who were desperate to get cultural knowledge back in place, but they were looking at a young generation that had been displaced in such a way that they just didn't have access to it. Certainly, things like political humor are desperately needed in desperate situations, and I'm sure that that's thriving.
And those traditions tend to be very durable, even in circumstances of great trial.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a story, again, this one was told right about the time of the Soviet invasion. And the story goes that there was a mountain kingdom that was besieged, and eventually the conquerors came riding in, and they came into the capital, and they marched into the room of government. At the top end of that room was a high seat, which was empty, and the conquering general walked in and said, "What's that?" And the elders of the conquered people said, "Oh, that's the high seat of our government, that's where our leader sits." And the general smiled, and he marched up and sat in the seat, and then the conquered elders smiled too, because that seat was kept empty. That was the seat of their god, and they knew that if somebody sat in that seat, people would rise up and kick them out.
Margaret Mills is chair of the Near East Studies Department at Ohio State University and author of Rhetoric and Politics in Afghan Traditional Storytelling. We talk about the poetry and literature of today's Afghanistan.
A thirst is inside us. The thirst of bold, burning deserts. The thirst of scarlet days. The thirst for wild storms. Our branches cold. Our roots dried up. Our gardens gone. Our bushes withered. A thirst is inside us, the thirst for many long years, many long voiceless years. A thirst is inside us, ardent.
Although no longer this land of poets, Afghanistan still has its writers, mostly in exile. Wali Ahmadi is a professor of Persian literature in the Near Eastern Studies Department at the University of California in Berkeley. He brought us up to date on today's Afghan writers and what they're writing about. I guess the first question is, and you've partly answered it by your reading, but are Afghans writing how and where?
As a matter of fact, Afghan literature not only exists, but in fact it has burgeoned in the last 20 years of war. Literature in moments of crisis especially becomes important, and I think the case of Afghan literature is no exception. The Soviet invasion, the subsequent civil war, the rise of the Taliban have given the Afghan poets and writers further impetus to write. And for them, the notion of literature and literary production has begun to have a sort of existential meaning. To write means life.
And what are the major themes emerging out of those 20 years of Afghan literature, and are they different from traditional themes?
Of course, when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, it had an unparalleled effect on literature in Afghanistan. There emerged a sort of establishment literature, a literature with a lot of institutional backing by the Soviets and the Soviet-installed regime in Kabul. It was a very highly ideologically charged literature, a literature of us versus them, that is, the toiling masses of Afghanistan versus the reactionary elements. On the other hand, the opposition forces fighting the Soviets, they had their own ideologically charged literature of us versus them, that is, that the people of Afghanistan fighting the great superpower of the Soviet Union. In the meantime, on the side, on the margins, we see a non-establishment literature, which was both very much aware of historical realities in Afghanistan, but also produced exemplary works in terms of literary technique and value, which, of course, distinguishes literature from non-literature in Afghanistan, in Persian literature especially.
You read for us, as we opened, a poem. Perhaps the title is Thirst?
Exactly.
Interpret it for us, if you would.
Well, in many ways, this particular poem tells us a lot about the issues that African poets and writers are facing today. That is that, in many ways, we have been victims of the political situation in the country, but at the same time, of course, we are longing for liberation, genuine liberation, and true freedom in the country. And African poets and writers are very much would like to see themselves as part of a contributing element, actually, for the emergence and strengthening of a viable, progressive, forward-looking, a pluralistic, a stable civil society in Afghanistan. And this poem, in many ways, is a sort of a yearning for future, which is, of course, there. And it is very much realizable. But how and under what circumstances is, of course, the question.
How has literature flourished or not flourished under the Taliban? Have people been writing inside Afghanistan, or is it a literature of exiles at this point?
This is a very good question. As soon as the Taliban took over, as a matter of fact, no publication has been available in Afghanistan.
I want to be sure I understand. You're saying nothing has been published under the Taliban?
No, nothing at all, actually. No book of poetry or fiction has appeared under the Taliban. Established poets and recognized writers in Afghanistan have not been able to write at all, and most of them have left the country in the first place. They have chosen exile, mostly in the neighboring countries of Iran and Pakistan. And they're, of course, originally quite disillusioned and dispirited, but slowly and slowly they have emerged as a very important element in the writing and production of literature in Afghanistan. And today, in fact, I could say that the cities of Mashhad in Iran and the city of Peshawar in Pakistan have been actually the main centers of literary production by Afghan writers abroad in exile.
And the themes now, you mentioned the longing for freedom, the longing to break through this dark period Afghanistan has been in. Is it hopeful? Is it bleak?
Well, I would call it a self-reflexive literature, a self-critical literature, a literature which no longer adheres to, as I said, this ideology of previous two decades, but at the same time, it's hopeful that, of course, the future is bright, but the history is fraught with complications, stubborn obstacles, and very difficult terrain. And it's the commitment of Afghan writers today to find out that let's get away from the old traditional ideological literature of before and look more critically into these complicated obstacles that have brought us to the situation that we are in today and find out how to get out of the crisis that we are in.
Wally Ahmadi, as the United States now engages with Afghanistan with an intensity and perhaps a duration that we really never have before, what's important for Americans to understand out of contemporary Afghan writing?
Well, I think literature in many ways tells us a lot about the people in Afghanistan, and I'm pretty sure the few translations that are available of Afghan writers, poets especially, could tell us a lot about what's going on in Afghanistan today. And I hope that the American media and American institutions, they would help bring out Afghan literature and make them known to the world, because without that, I think our understanding of Afghan society will be rather impaired.
You gave us a reading of poetry. What other forms are being exercised now? Are there Afghan novels?
Afghan novels were not written, let's say, 20 years ago, with a few, very few exceptions. But tell you the truth, in the last five, 6 years, we've seen an array of novels being written in Iran and Pakistan by Afghan writers. And that again tells us that for the first time we see a sort of this exile, this crisis that we are in, as a matter of fact, has been rather productive, at least in certain areas, especially in the writing of novels. They are not really being translated into English, but in fact some Afghan novels have been translated into other European languages like Spanish, French especially, and German.
What's the view of Islam that emerges in contemporary Afghan writing?
This is a very difficult question, and I've not really looked into that, but for most Afghan writers, the notion of Islam has been a given. They are not really engaging with it as a source of either in opposition or otherwise.
Even though the Taliban has been pushing such a puritanical version of Islam?
Oh, in fact, that kind of puritanical version has been criticized in various ways by Afghan writers of today. And most Afghans, of course, believe in a more moderate form of Islam. And Afghan literature, especially Afghan fiction, produced by women. Mm-hmm. One example would be Maryam Mahboob, a contemporary Afghan writer. The way she writes about the issues of women and caught in the midst of this puritanical interpretation that the Taliban are offering shows clearly that it's anathema to many Afghans and this interpretation by the Taliban. And Afghan writers are, of course, reflecting that in their work.
And what about the notion of Afghans' place in the world and Afghans' relationships with foreigners?
Well, that too, Afghan fiction of today, it is not really a isolated literature. Afghan writers have been avid readers of Joyce and Proust. If I can tell you that today, no Afghan writer could be found that has not read Joyce. And Persian translation, of course, is impossible to do. And Afghan writers, especially the modernist ones, the experimental ones, they're very much aware of what's going on in the rest of the world. They are very much reading works produced in other languages, through translation mostly, but still. And it reflects itself in the techniques that they are using. So as much as the world doesn't know about Afghan literature, Afghan writers know a lot about the world.
Wally Ahmadi, I'd love it if you'd do another reading for us.
I'll read another short poem. This poem is called From the Pit of Hell, and it is written by Wasif Bakhtari, the preeminent Afghan poet in the Persian language writing today.
And what does it describe or refer to before we hear
it's actually written in prison in Kabul in 1979, and that was the beginning of the communist takeover of Afghanistan, and the poet was imprisoned for his belief there and in prison, and he wrote this particular poem in prison. And we could see in the imagery of the poem that it's actually a prison poem. It's actually addressed to the guardsman, the one who is standing in prison guarding the prisoners. I'll read the first part. O guard, for heaven's sake, for a moment, open this mouth, this heavy lock, from the hands of the cell, till from this inferno, this burning hell, fired by bloody bones, the souls of the chained ones might rise beyond the walls. Oh my God, tonight, once again, the cry of a child from the other side of the wall broke the sleep of those in chains. Once again, the ruthless castle keeper slashed the tassels of his bloody whip on the soft, silky ground of somebody. Oh God, for heaven's sake, tell me, whose dear child is that? Aren't these voices from the three links that bend me to this life? Aren't these cries those of my beloved?
Wally Ahmadi is professor of Persian literature in the Near Eastern Studies Department at the University of California at Berkeley. Share your thoughts on the poetry and literature of Afghanistan. Go to our website at wbur.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Special Coverage is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Nate DeMeo, Eileen Imada, Karen Schiffman, and Keith Shields, with help from Tim Skog and Michael Garth. John Roberts directs. James Ross is our technical director. The senior producer of Special Coverage is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.
From Boston University, this is WBUR Boston's NPR News.